Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Jazz. Hi, Mukund. I'm so happy to be with you guys again. And Happy New Year, everyone that's listening. I think this probably will be posted when we are in 2026 already. So that's very exciting. I wish everyone a great year. What's new with me? I'm in the middle of match season, so getting done with interviews and very excited for the match coming up. So fingers crossed, everyone. Let's manifest for neurology residency for me. And yeah, I'm really happy. And how about you, Mukund? How are you?
Hey guys, nice to be back. I'm working hard. Intern year is difficult. I'm post-call from a 28-hour call shift right now, learning a lot, growing a lot, being humbled every day. But it's a privilege to be in medicine.
This is why I love you both. You guys are exhausted. You guys are stressed for other things. And here we are recording because we love medical education. We love medicine. And for me personally, honestly, I've been busy trying to balance being a father and then also trying to survive attending life as well. And just seeing my 8-month-old going from being a potato to now crawling and babbling and smiling and laughing, it's been a good perspective on life. So anyways, enough of that intro stuff. Let's get started in the case. Are we ready? All right, so Aliquot 1. This is a 73-year-old female who presented to the hospital for shortness of breath. She says over the past few days, she kind of developed this progressive dyspnea. She was able to walk around her trailer before. Now she needed to kind of stop frequently in order to catch her breath. She also reported a productive cough with clear sputum, but no hemoptysis, no chest pain or palpitations. The day before the ED visit, she had like this sudden episode of severe shortness of breath that lasted approximately 2 hours and did not get any better. And when she came into the ED, she also denied wheezing, congestion, sore throat, sick contacts, or any type of fevers. And I'll stop here for the first aliquot.
Amazing. Great start to the case. Thank you, Jess. So we have an older lady that's presenting with worsening dyspnea on exertion. And we're talking about dyspnea, my mind goes straight to the dyspnea pyramid, which is the CP Solvers classic. And this pyramid includes three levels, starting with the lungs on the base, the heart, and then the miscellaneous category on the top. And so please refer to the website for a detailed breakdown of each category and the beautiful graphic. However, in real life, when I see a patient that comes to the ED with dyspnea, I ask them to start two triage questions that often help me progress on my diagnosis. The first one being, do they have a fever? And the second, do they have signs or symptoms of volume overload? And the reason why I ask about these two symptoms or associated signs is because there are two most common causes of dyspnea are pneumonia and congestive heart failure. And oftentimes pneumonia comes with fever and congestive heart failure with signs of volume overload. Our patient here does not have fever or any signs of volume overload so far, but does refer an exertional component to her symptoms, which classically would make me think about cardiac disease. However, the big caveat here is that in real life, a lot of systems can cause dyspnea on exertion, including the lungs, as with diseases such as very common diseases such as asthma, and even causes on the miscellaneous category on the top of the pyramid, such as anemia. She also refers about productive cough. And you know, I think of cough as a protective mechanism of the airways. Thank you very much, vagus nerve. That's a little like neurology nugget. And the receptors that trigger this reflex can be chemical, sensitive to, you know, for example, inflammatory cytokines, and, you know, the most common one being in the setting of pneumonia, but they can also be mechanic or stretch receptors. And this can be triggered by expansion of the alveoli if they are filled by fluid, which can happen when patients have congestive heart failure. Does the fact that the cough is productive sway me one way or the other, meaning away from the heart or the lungs? Not really. I think we all learn in medical school typical features of sputum colors and textures as clues of particular diseases. But unless you tell me the patient has red currant jelly sputum, I'm still on the lung versus heart branch point. You know, they make great exam questions, but hold little sensitivity and specificity on real life. What is also very interesting in this case is a hyperacute exacerbation of her dyspnea. That was what brought her to the ED. And for this type of disease, I also like to take an anatomical approach. From the top down, I start with the upper airway, making sure there's no foreign object, any signs of a stridor that could suggest a laryngospasm or, you know, a rash that could make me think of an angioedema also presenting with upper airway disease. And going down to the lower airways, I get my stethoscope and check for wheezing. Common things being common, I don't want to miss a case of like an asthma exacerbation or COPD. And then we can also, if we see or hear crackles or diminished breath sounds with a stethoscope, this could also suggest there's fluid on the alveoli or pleura, which can also cause dyspnea. Crossing the diffusion membrane from the alveoli to the vessels, we get to the pulmonary artery. And of course, we don't want to miss a PE, a very common or like scary cause of hyperacute dyspnea. And finally, we get to the pump, the heart. And in this category, we want to make sure that the conduction system, the muscle itself, and the pericardium covering the heart are okay. So yeah, all this just to say that I want to know the vitals of this patient. I want to get oxygen if they need it, get an EKG, TROPS, check test rate, all the things. Yeah, I'll pass the mic to you, Jess, for the second oligraph.
Awesome. Great job, Valle. I really liked how you went through the pyramid and highlighted some things that you thought were really important. So excellent job. All right. Aliquot number two. So she has a past medical history of hypertension, COPD, coronary artery disease, type 2 diabetes. I think it was like over 15 years ago, she had a history of colon cancer and had a right colectomy for that. And then she also has history of GERD. So just to give you guys some insight, when she came into the ED, she was found to have heart rate of 151. The ED docs immediately got an EKG, which showed AFib with RVR, in addition to some non-specific T-wave inversions. Her blood pressure was 175 over 95. Her oxygen initially was about 60%, but then improved to 96% on 4 liters. So pretty significant improvement there. She had a fever of 102.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And after getting a dose of Lopressor from the ED, her heart rate went down from 151 to 110. On exam, she was in mild distress and anxious, but was not toxic appearing. For her cardiovascular exam, she had an irregular rhythm and it was tachycardic. On her lung exam, she had crackles in the lower bilateral bases and some crackles in the middle lobes as well. Her GI exam was unremarkable, so soft, no tenderness of palpation. And her extremities were noted to have maybe like mild plus one pitting edema, mostly up and around the ankle area, but not all the way to the shin. She also got a CTA chest, also was all done in the ED, because Valle, you mentioned that you don't want to miss PE, and the ED docs were thinking the same way. And the CTA chest was negative for a pulmonary embolism. Did show mild interstitial pulmonary edema, but like nothing that really caught everyone's attention. In the ED, she also got a dose of 40 milligrams of IV Lasix because of this mild pulmonary edema finding. She was also noted to have a positive delta of troponins. I'm sorry, I don't have the specific values, but she did have an elevated troponin delta. And then she also did have, because of that, she was started on a heparin drip and was given aspirin 324 milligrams. And because there was the fever and the, you know, abnormal CT chest, the ED docs also gave her ceftriaxone and azithromycin for possible pneumonia. Other labs, she had a leukocytosis of 10.2, a hemoglobin of 7.8, and a hematocrit of 27, MCV of 80, platelets of 178. Her comprehensive metabolic panel, sodium 142, potassium 3.6, chloride of 105, bicarb of 31. Her creatinine was 1.7, the baseline of 1. She had a BUN of 33 and a GFR of 40. There was also a notable of a lactate elevation of 6.9. A lot of going on, a pretty rich aliquot, and I'll pause there.
Wow, there is a lot to think about here. So let's go back to the problem representation. I'm going to try and give you another one. So we now know that this is a 73-year-old woman with a history of coronary artery disease, COPD, and colon cancer status post-hemicolectomy, presenting with acute dyspnea and found to have new severe anemia, AFib and RVR, and NSTEMI with lactic acidosis. We had a lot of data presented to us in this last aliquot, so I'm just going to try and pull out some of the things that stood out to me. A couple of key points that draw my attention. She's hypertensive to the 170s on admission. She's profoundly hypoxemic to 60%, but improved pretty quickly with just 4 liters of O2. She's febrile on presentation, and she's productive of clear sputum, and she's coughing with this kind of subacute lead up to an acute and a rapid decompensation in her respiratory status that triggered her presentation to the hospital. So this is acute on subacute dyspnea in my mind. With us, it sounds like she appears volume overloaded, but that most of that volume lives in her lungs with more pulmonary congestion than peripheral edema proportionately, suggesting that there's probably some degree of acuity to the pulmonary edema, at least in my mind. And then also she has an NSTEMI evidenced by T-wave inversions and a dynamic troponin elevation, though we don't have the exact numbers to see, you know, how rapidly the trope is rising or if it's kind of close to its plateau. But notably, she doesn't have chest pain. Also, she has an impressive lactic acidosis to 6.9, and she's anemic to 7.8 from an unknown baseline. I want to try and put this case together overall to start before diving into one of our CP solver schemas to reassure myself that this lactate, one of the most concerning data points that's jumping out at me, doesn't necessarily mean the patient is actively in shock. I think it's really fascinating also to reflect on how my own learning process has changed so much about halfway into my first year of residency, and how cases like this, even on a week-to-week basis, after having seen similar presentations and really having played an active role in their management, like the way I conceptualize these kinds of cases really changes, even from a week-to-week basis. So I'm going to try and frame this the way I think about it at my stage of training, and hopefully that's helpful to you. So big picture, our lady seems to have acute on subacute dyspnea, or maybe even acute on subacute on chronic dyspnea, which I think could have a number of etiologies. She has COPD at baseline, but her exam doesn't really scream COPD exacerbation. If anything, it sounds like she's probably brewing some kind of community-acquired pneumonia for a few days before all of this kicked off, with her fever and her dyspnea and her sputum production, or maybe with that GERD history, she just aspirated a little bit at home and has like an aspiration pneumonia. Now, why the acute change for the worse before she came to the emergency department? I think two main possibilities jump out at me, and both involve her having some kind of undiagnosed HFpEF physiology, which is, I think, very likely in this lady with longstanding hypertension and metabolic comorbidities. Probably some myocardial remodeling and diastolic dysfunction are certainly at play here. So in one case, the infection was a trigger for new AFib, which had a rapid ventricular response, and she really depended on that atrial kick and a slower rate for diastolic filling. So the acute pulmonary edema and the decompensation is all driven by her arrhythmia. Then the other possibility, which I find really interesting, is that this is all SCAPE, or sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema, which also is commonly known as flash pulmonary edema. She was quite hypertensive on admission, and maybe the AFib is just secondary. Generally, I think of acute AFib as a two-hit phenomenon, you know, where the underlying cardiac substrate has some dysfunction from a surgery, chronic pressure overload, myocardial remodeling, valvular disease, and then there's an acute insult, some autonomic disturbance, an electrolyte imbalance, infection, or a volume shift that triggers the AFib itself. And here, I think we have a pretty convincing story for the interplay of AFib and flash pulmonary edema as the most likely driver for presentation. Although I think in my mind, still, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. Then we have the NSTEMI. She has dynamic troponins and T-wave inversions on EKG. It'll be important to trend those troponins to their peak and keep looking at the EKG to see if it evolves. But overall for her, at this point, with the information that I have, I'm favoring a type 2 etiology as opposed to a type 1, a plaque rupture. She doesn't have chest pain. She doesn't have ST segment changes that we're told about. And she has several risk factors for a supply-demand mismatch, which is really fundamentally the process driving myocardial injury in a type 2 NSTEMI. She has severe anemia. She has hypoxemia. She has new tachycardia in the setting of that AFib. And Jazz, I appreciate the management that you've outlined above. I think she should definitely get cardiac catheterization at some point this admission, and then we can manage her medically and unless she starts to decompensate any further. So, you know, I think I've taken us along a journey to try and frame this case overall, big picture. And I'm still left with this question of why does she have a lactate of 6.9, which when I first heard about it, I was quite nervous. And, you know, I think indeed she could have a mixed shock picture with distributive and cardiogenic etiologies, I think being the most likely players for her. But I, again, reassuringly, I think she's warm, she's perfusing her extremities, she's not dramatically volume overloaded, and she has a broad pulse pressure that specifically argues against cardiogenic shock. She's hypertensive, which makes septic shock a little unlikely. Although she could just be in like an early compensatory phase for evolving sepsis. So she needs to have a very close eye kept on her. And yeah, like while I would monitor her very closely, I think that we can kind of go through the lactic acidosis differential diagnosis. And the more I think about the lactate, I think the more etiologies there are for that lactic acidosis that aren't necessarily indicative of shock. So the CP Solvers website has a schema for lactic acidosis, which is divided into type A, where lactate is produced at its core by tissue hypoperfusion or some kind of supply-demand mismatch in tissue metabolism. And then there's type B, which is produced by altered metabolism, like in states of mitochondrial dysfunction or reduced clearance. I think there are some elements of type A and type B in this case. On the type A front, I think I've made my case that she's not, like, for example, in normotensive cardiogenic shock. So I don't think this is a true hypoperfusive lactic acidosis. But I think there could definitely be lactate production from the 1-2 hit of she's very anemic and she's very hypoxemic. So really the oxygen carrying capacity of her blood on presentation was so low that there probably was true systemic cellular hypoxia. That's probably the most likely type A driver. But then there are also a variety of possible type B etiologies. We know that sepsis in and of itself, even without causing septic shock, can cause a lactic acidosis because of all of those inflammatory cytokines that are released at any stage in the septic process. One proposed mechanism is that they alter mitochondrial metabolism and that they inhibit pyruvate dehydrogenase, which, as we know, is one of the key enzymatic players in reverting pyruvate to glucose along the gluconeogenic pathway, which is the key method of lactate clearance. I think sympathetic stimulation can also lead to a type B lactic acidosis just by driving more anaerobic metabolism. If this is a SCAPE, she probably has tons of catecholaminergic stimulation that's floating around. And if she has COPD and she got a bunch of beta agonism in the form of dual nebs, albuterol nebulizers, in the emergency department, that I've also seen cause a very significant lactic acidosis in some patients. With a new AKI, she's probably not clearing lactate appropriately. And then nutritional deficiencies like thiamine, which is a pyruvate dehydrogenase cofactor, could also contribute. And then if we're thinking very broadly, she's diabetic, she's a type 2 diabetic, maybe she's taking metformin, and then metformin could contribute to this lactic acidosis. Ultimately, the workup for this would start with a VBG for me. It would be really useful to see if she's actually acidemic or if she just has this lactic acidosis. Because look at her bicarb, it's 31. So what's her actual pH? Is she chronically metabolically compensating for something? Is it this that she's compensating for? Or is she compensating for like a baseline hypercapnia, CO2 retention in the setting of her COPD? It would be a very interesting acid-base problem. So I'd be curious to dig deeper into that. Overall, I hope I haven't gone down too many tangents. It was a really complex case with a lot of data. Really, really interesting first aliquot for me. I'm eager to see where the case goes.
Wow, Mukund. I think it's very easy to get overwhelmed with when you have such a rich aliquot like this. And I think you did a really good job of triaging here. I think you did a really good job of triaging the points that were probably be the most important to address. So I think you really did a great job. And we were equally curious about what the bicarb of 31, despite having a severe lactic acidosis. I unfortunately wasn't taking care of the patient at that time. I started taking the care of the patient like kind of halfway through hospitalization, but I'll save further commentary for later. So aliquot number three, cardiology, as you predicted, Mukund, performed a coronary angiogram for the patient's end STEMI, and it showed a single vessel coronary artery disease with a normal LVEDP. And over the next couple of days, so basically since that first check of hemoglobin of 7.8, like 48 hours later, her hemoglobin downtrended to 6.8. I think 6 months ago, her last hemoglobin was 10.5. Iron was low at 6. TIBC was 305, and TSAT was also low at 5%, and ferritin was also low at 44. B12 was low at 118. Folate, however, was normal. The occult was positive. She denied hematochezia to us, and she actually wasn't sure if she was having melanotic stools at home, but the nurse, she did have multiple bowel movements since her admission. But there was only one mention of a melanotic stool per the RN report. And again, patient wasn't really sure about it. Patient states that she, you know, does not use any NSAIDs, no alcohol. And we checked her PTT and INR, which were also normal. I'll pause there for Valerie to tackle the third aliquot.
So what is causing the anemia in these patients? So the CP Solver's website has an schema on anemia. However, I don't think it's worth going all over it because this patient clearly has signs that they may be bleeding. So I'm just going to point out that when it comes to anemia, the first branch point is going to define the tempo. And this is where Mukund's teaching point really comes into place. As we outlined on the first aliquot, severe acute anemia can present with dyspnea, and this would suggest a rapid drop in the hemoglobin. Moreover, this has downtrended and worsened during the hospitalization. So it makes me think that it's, you know, an acute worsening of her anemia at least. And as Mukund outlined, you know, the MCV can help us because of the response that one would expect if there's chronic bleeding. You know, the bone marrow would be more active and the reticulocytes would be higher, and the reticulocytes being bigger cells, we would expect a normalization or an increase on the MCV rather than what we're seeing right now, which is on the lower side of the normal range. So this is a way that could help us clue if this is acute versus a chronic progressive drop of the hemoglobin. And when it comes to acute anemia, we should rule out hemolysis and active bleeding. And, you know, given the patient in this case had a melanotic stool, I think, you know, of course, bleeding is the most likely scenario. With her past medical history of colon cancer, I would be first worried about a recurrence of malignancy, even though, you know, classically in medical school, we were taught that melena or like dark, tarry stools suggest an upper GI bleed. I think the past medical history is so significant in this case that it will be really hard for me to, you know, omit a colonoscopy and just go with an endoscopy to look for the origin of this bleed, because I would be concerned of our occurrence of the malignancy. She also had a right colectomy in her past medical history, which, depending on when this was, could lead to several complications, from an anastomosis leak that, you know, could bleed, to also like a vessel injury during the procedure that can also be a source of bleeding. I'm not a surgeon and I don't want to be a surgeon, so please, if you're a surgeon and you're listening to this episode, don't come for me. And yeah, when it comes to other causes of GI bleed, particularly in the age group of this patient, I think vascular malformations are also a possibility, particularly on the lower GI tract, such as arteriovenous malformations and angiodysplasias. And I think Jess made a great point ruling out risk factors for causes of upper GI bleed, which would classically present with melena, such as ulcers or, you know, cirrhosis leading to varices in the esophagus. So, you know, ruling out NSAID use, alcohol consumption, and, you know, any stigmata of cirrhosis that could put this patient on a vulnerable position. So yeah, those are my thoughts. I'm very eager for some endoscopy and colonoscopy, please.
Awesome. Great job, Valet. I really love the approach of breaking down the anemia further. Okay, so aliquot number four, you both asked for it or suggested it, and here it is. We were able to get GI to do an EGD, and in the stomach, they found a moderate gastric enteral vascular ectasia, also known as GAVE. And once they found this, they treated it with APC, so they kind of cauterized it. Within the stomach, they also noticed that there was no masses, no polyps, and no other erosive changes. They did take some biopsies of the vascular ectasias that they saw. And rest of the gastric fundus or cardia did not find any abnormalities. The duodenum was normal with no masses, no AVMs, no erosive changes. I will pause right there.
So we have GAVE. GAVE is a really cool entity. I've had a couple of cases of it so far, mostly in medical school, but I've seen them be very challenging to manage. I'm very, very far from an expert here, but I'll give it my best shot with the reading that I've done in the past with previous cases and talking through how this new finding changes our reasoning. So GAVE is a disorder of vascular formation that we don't really understand the pathophysiology for. There is a very active field of research in trying to understand, you know, which vascular mediators and growth factors are dysregulated, whether this is like a pathophys that results from aggressive antral contraction, although there are some subtypes of GAVE where the watermelon banding progresses beyond the antrum. So that hypothesis doesn't universally make sense. And the fact that it's associated with such a pleomorphic set of disease entities also kind of complicates, I think, our understanding of its pathophysiology. But at its core, it presents as a longitudinal stripes of this kind of hyperemic gastric tissue that radiate from the pylorus with these ectatic vessels that classically look like a watermelon endoscopically. And I was actually, I had the good luck to be in the EGD suite when people were being scoped with GAVE a couple of times. And I actually don't think that I ever really was convinced that I saw a watermelon, but it's certainly a memorable way to think about the illness. There are two main subtypes of GAVE. There's a non-cirrhotic, which may occur as an isolated problem, but has associations with a spectrum of other diseases, notably CKD, metabolic syndrome, and autoimmune disease, which I'll talk about more in a little bit. And then cirrhotic GAVE is the other subtype, and I think the more common subtype overall. But very notably, the endoscopic findings of GAVE and of portal hypertensive gastropathy can be confused at times. So these two entities need to be distinguished because the pathophysiology is quite different. And the treatment is also quite different because portal hypertensive gastropathy, ultimately, if it's severe, the correction is TIPS to relieve the portal pressures. But there's plenty of evidence to show that relief of portal hypertension doesn't cause an improvement in GAVE. Just kind of as a tangent, one of the interesting parts of GAVE cases I've seen has been trying to classify the endoscopic appearance and associate it with its underlying etiology. There are a couple of endoscopic subtypes. There's a linear striped type, which is kind of the classic watermelon appearance. There's a punctate subtype, and there's a nodular subtype. And of course, because it is overall more closely associated with cirrhosis, all three of these are seen more frequently in cirrhosis. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, the punctate subtype is most closely associated with cirrhotic GAVE. But I don't have information for this case on what the subtype of the endoscopic appearance was, but I think it's just kind of fun to pontificate as an academic exercise. Either way, it doesn't seem like there's any evidence of cirrhosis in this case. So we're dealing with the non-cirrhotic subtype of GAVE. I don't know yet that we have enough information given the initial presentation of this case to take us to a unifying diagnosis or like an underlying syndrome that ties all of these findings together. But I think now is a pretty good time to say, hey, this isn't cirrhotic GAVE. It is often associated with autoimmune disease. Let's do an autoimmune review of systems and ask the patient about things like joint and muscle symptoms, skin and nail changes, oral ulcers, nasal ulcers, hair loss, Raynaud's, family history of autoimmune disease. And if we are dealing with autoimmunity, the most classic association is systemic sclerosis. I won't, you know, go too into the weeds about this until we have more information, but there is some really interesting literature on the people with GAVE of any subtype having cutaneous telangiectasias, kind of a la Crest syndrome. So there are some people out there in the reading that I had done about, you know, who are like hypothesizing that there was some underlying autoimmune pathology driving both GAVE and systemic sclerosis. So I just more pontificating at this point, but kind of interesting to speculate on the underlying mechanisms. The management of GAVE these days is primarily endoscopic. Surgical enterectomy has also been used, but that's really for super refractory cases that are transfusion dependent on a regular basis. The cases that I've seen have been treated with argon plasma coagulation or APC, which is the mainstay of intervention. There's also a few other types of intervention, things like neodymium YAG laser photocoagulation and band ligation, which have been used in other cases. The real question that I have on my mind at this point in the case is, why did this lady who has been on the planet for 70-something years suddenly develop GAVE at this point in her life? And we may never come to a conclusive answer, but I do wonder if there's an underlying autoimmune question to be answered here. As we know, many autoimmune diseases have a bimodal distribution of incidence, with many cases happening in the 30s and 40s, and then again, kind of a second wind of cases happening in people 60s and 70s, as we start to see age and senescence-related changes in immune function and reduced immune tolerance. So I'm very interested in how the rest of this case goes, but super cool. I really like GAVE. I really enjoyed the cases of GAVE that I've seen. So it's kind of nice to have this be a part of CP Solvers.
I'm glad, McCune, because you did a really good job of dissecting that. That was a really great breakdown of differentials of GAVE. And I'll be honest, your insight was a lot more deeper than mine. So I basically started taking care of this patient after the EGD. I started service then. And, you know, I didn't know much about GAVE at the time. And the only thing I was familiar with was the cirrhosis. And when this patient, you know, did not show any sequela or any stigmata of cirrhosis, that got me very curious. So moving on to aliquot number five. So this is when further history was obtained from the patient. You know, she did endorse to me that she has had Raynaud's phenomenon of both of her hands, which she's been told many years ago that it was idiopathic. She denies any history of joint pains or dysphagia. She did say to me that she's been having like this chronic mouth pain, and it kind of feels like just got burning pain in her mouth. And she says her doctors gave her like a numbing gel that she uses for it, but she denied any sores or ulcers, no rashes, no changes in her skin, nail beds or anything like that. And the next aliquot will reveal the final diagnosis.
Wow, very interesting. So I've never seen GAFE. I'm not really familiar with it. So I'm really, really happy that we get this case to learn about something quite new for me. So as Mukund mentioned, GAFE is associated with several autoimmune diseases, in particular systemic sclerosis or scleroderma. And our patient now refers to Raynaud's phenomenon, which is a vasospastic disorder that decreases the blood flow to the fingers and toes and presents usually as cold fingers or cold toes with color changes, in particular when someone is exposed to cold temperatures. And you know, may also be associated with tingling, numbness, and you know, if the cold exposure is quite severe, it can even lead to the ulcers in the fingertips. And when it's true Raynaud, it can be primary or idiopathic, as this patient was told apparently, and this type usually presents in younger females without any other symptoms. And in contrast, secondary Raynaud's can be part of various systemic diseases, such as lupus, scleroderma, rheumatoid arthritis, or even exposure to certain drugs or chemicals. And, you know, just review of systems is really setting us up to rule out systemic autoimmune diseases. And to confirm if this is true, Raynaud's, because as you can probably agree, Raynaud's or the thought of someone having Raynaud's is quite common, but true Raynaud's, it's not. So how can we confirm if this is true Raynaud's? We can do nail fold capillary microscopy, which can also help us differentiate between primary versus secondary Raynaud's. And, you know, using a dermatoscope or an ophthalmoscope even, we could look for changes on the vessel morphology that, you know, could lead us to this being part of a connective tissue disease. And for example, you know, megacapillaries with decreased capillary density are usually the findings that we would expect on someone having a scleroderma and Raynaud's being part of that presentation. And then there's also the mouth pain that this patient refers to, which is quite interesting. From my reading, I've learned that Raynaud's could also present with mouth pain, and it can affect the face in various parts like the ears, and it can also affect places beyond the fingertips, such as the knees and even the nipples. So it would be really important to ask when does this pain occur and if it's worse with exposure to certain temperatures, and examine the mouth as well. We don't want to rule out, you know, a toothache or something like that. That could be, you know, just a red herring in this case. And, you know, even though she does not refer typical dysphagia, she does have a history of GERD, which could suggest esophageal disease, which paired with Raynaud's, you know, raises the possibility of what Mukund mentioned, which is Kress syndrome, which is, you know, one of the versions of scleroderma, or like the, so to speak, the limited version of scleroderma. And Kress stands for calcinosis, Raynaud's, esophageal dysfunction, sclerodectomy, and telangiectasia. So we have potentially Raynaud's, and we have potentially esophageal dysfunction. I will look to complete the acronym for bumps or tightness on the skin, hyper or depigmentation, like the classical salt and pepper pattern, as well as typical facies that could accompany this syndrome, like the mask-like appearance seen in scleroderma patients, a big shaped nose, and furrowing on the contour of the mouth. And, you know, to complete our workup or our suspicion of scleroderma being the case here, or Kress syndrome, I would send some antibodies. So we have anti-topoisomerase, anti-centromere, and anti-RNA polymerase that could help us confirm or maybe put part of the way our hypothesis. So yeah, I'm on the edge of my seat, Jess. What's next?
Amazing breakdown, Valet. We were very concerned at that point for some type of underlying autoimmune condition. The ANCA came back negative. SCL70 came back negative. The ANA came back positive with a titer of greater than 1 to 2,560, and it was a centromere pattern. And then the centromere antibody came back pretty positive as well. The initial presentation, I think you guys were bang on with the anemia. The progressive shortness of breath was likely from just the progressive anemia. Now let's talk about the finding, the EGD findings and GAVE. So first of all, what is GAVE? It's an acquired vascular ectasia of the stomach. It's usually in the antrum. And the interesting part is it causes chronic occult bleeding, and it usually manifests as iron deficiency anemia. Very less commonly, it can lead to an overt upper GI bleed. So her drop in hemoglobin, over the last 6 months, it was probably happening slowly over those 6 months. And I don't think there was a tipping point where she went from, let's say, 10 to like 6. Usually GAVE does not present like that. On the EGD, it typically has longitudinal red stripes radiating from the pylorus all the way down. That's what leads to that watermelon appearance. And it's also known as a watermelon stomach. Usually when you are suspecting GAVE, you should always ask for EGDs, because more extensive vascular ectasia will have spindle cell proliferation, which can help distinguish between GAVE and portal hypertensive gastropathy. And then the etiology of GAVE. So like I said, cirrhosis by far, it's like 30%. Of GAVE cases are associated with cirrhosis. In patients who don't have cirrhosis, so cirrhosis has already been ruled out, the remaining 60% of cases are autoimmune or connective tissue disease. Now let's bring that over to our patient. When it comes to autoimmune conditions, systemic sclerosis or CREST syndrome, both of them have its associations, strongest associations with GAVE. So in this patient, can it be possible that she have, the diagnosis of CREST syndrome without any other manifestations? It's possible. Unfortunately, she was supposed to follow up outpatient rheumatology and she never did. Specifically, I wanted them to do a nail fold capillaroscopy to see if she had evidence of scleroderma, at least CREST syndrome. And there's been a lot of reports of visceral, pulmonary and GI involvement of scleroderma and Raynaud's without skin thickening. So it sometimes can be elusive to the naked eye. And the next thing I wanted to talk about is how can scleroderma lead to GAVE, mechanistically wise? So we know that scleroderma leads to vasculopathy. It leads to the mucosal injury, and then that leads to the ectasia and bleeding. And that's the same mechanism how CREST syndrome patients have telangiectasias. Now, this GERD history, which is actually pretty interesting, she told me that for the last couple of weeks, her appetite hasn't been the greatest, and she feels that every time she eats something, she got really full, and which is why I was suspicious that she might have had an aspiration event at home when she had that sudden decline, and then improved with oxygen therapy, and sure, the antibiotics probably helped a little bit too. When you look at CREST syndrome, the mnemonic, C stands for calcinosis, and sure, she did not have that. I did not see any evidence of that. She did have this Raynaud's phenomenon. And I wonder now, in retrospect, if she had esophageal dysfunction, because she already had the acid reflux. And now I wonder if that decrease in motility of the esophagus put her at risk for aspiration. And just that decreased appetite in the last couple of weeks. I did not personally appreciate thickening or tightening of the skin. And then I did not see any obvious telangiectasias, but I'll be very honest. My exam skills for those two are probably not the most expert level of a rheumatologist, which is why I wanted her to see rheumatology. I think you guys already did a great job of talking about management, so I'm not going to go into that. But one thing I just want to talk about is when I didn't see that she had a stigmata of cirrhosis, I did ask the GI doc that could this have been a possible GAVE mimic? And some things to be worried, something that can look like a watermelon stomach, but it's not, is portal hypertensive gastropathy, which wouldn't really apply to her because she didn't have any evidence of portal hypertension. But sometimes in some patients who take a lot of NSAIDs, you can have reactive or erosive gastropathy. But the main one that you don't want to miss is, or like something that you want to make sure it's not, is like diffuse gastric vascular ectasia secondary to like angiodysplasias. But that's where the histology of the biopsy matters the most. So all in all, I think this case taught me not to just take certain diagnoses at face value. You know, dig deeper in terms of like what could the secondary causes be. I know this was a challenging case, but and it had a lot of moving parts. But I hope that clarifies how this patient presented with all the different red flags that popped up and the eventual diagnosis at the end. Thank you both, but you guys know what time it is, right?
Oh my God, I forgot about this.
It's time for a jazz joke. So let me ask you both. For GAVE, what type of anemia do patients present with? Wrong answers only.
I don't understand American humor. like normocytic?
Seedless anemia.
Oh, because it's watermelon? Oh, we're keeping this one. I think this is one of the better jazz jokes.
Like the spelling?
Seedless, like, you know, watermelons are
I'm so sorry. I'm so bad with American humor.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.